Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, good news on farming greenhouse gases, but with more to be done, what's next? We travel to the Skelligs to find out what you call a baby puffin. And Eurofinals on Sunday, did you know about the Castlemaine connection? It's a nice, bright, warm one out there this morning. There's a good bit of heat in that sun already. Up and out and at 'em, folks. This week saw some welcome progress on the reductions on Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions, according to the EPA report on 2023 emissions, which was published on Tuesday. Farming, as you know, accounts for just over one third of our emissions, and reducing them while continuing to farm profitably has proven a pretty tricky balancing act. So, how was this reduction achieved? Was it a one-off, or will it hopefully endure? And what could be done next? Professor Frank O'Mara is the director of Chagask, and he joins me in studio this morning. Very good morning, and thanks very much for coming in to us.
Good morning, Philip.
Frank, 4.6% reduction, while there were sectors like transport where it kept on increasing. Good news. Were you surprised by this, or did you expect it?
So, Philip, yes, it is very good news. It wasn't a surprise. You know, we could see the drivers of emissions. We knew, you know, things like fertiliser use, animal numbers and so on, that they had moved in the direction of a reduction in emissions. So we were expecting that. I didn't know what it would be, you know, so 4.6% was certainly at the upper end of my expectations, and I was delighted with that. And look, I think it's a great boost, really, for the many, many farmers who have been doing things over the last few years, things like, you know, adopting protected urea as their fertiliser, or reducing the amount of fertiliser they use, or maybe breeding better animals, to see that translating now into a good news story on the emissions front.
There's no doubt that farmers are doing much more than most in this area, but how much of that 4.6% should we put down to the weather and the fact that there was effectively less farming being done because of it?
So, of the 4.6%, about half of it came from both reduced fertiliser use and change into protected urea. Protected urea is a type of fertiliser that has lower emissions associated with it. So, you know, why do we see that? Well, over the last 2 years, we've seen a big drop in the fertiliser use. It's down, nitrogen fertiliser down 30% over those 2 years. And driven to a large extent, I suppose, or at least the stimulus was the big rise in fertiliser prices over the last 2 years due to the war in Ukraine and the increase in energy prices. That really, I suppose, galvanised farmers into seeing, well, how can we use less of this very expensive product and replace it with other sources? And that means making better use.
So some of it was coincidental, but on the good news side, there was also a change in the regulations on its spreading in the month of January.
There's a whole heap of changes in regulations about the timing and the amount of fertiliser that you can spread. But I wouldn't say it was just coincidental. Like, farmers had to respond to that. So they had to take active steps to actually, you know, continue to be able to feed their animals while at the same time using less fertiliser.
But the logic, unfortunately, of that suggests that were the price to come back down again, its use would swing back up.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. That's where farmers maybe have to plan, and hopefully those plans will stay in place now. So we did expect to see some rebound in fertiliser use in 2024 because the prices have come down. I'm not sure whether we will see much of a rebound because the weather was so bad earlier in the year that farmers maybe couldn't spread as much as they might have intended to. But we would hope that the plans that farmers put in place to manage with lower fertilisers, such as making better use of their slurry, maybe being a bit more judicious about when they apply that fertiliser, and as you say, the maximum levels have come down, so they can apply less, that all those will remain in place for this year and for succeeding years.
Talk to me a little bit more about protected urea and explain to me why, as a non-farmer, it seems to me like a bit of a no-brainer. It's cheaper and it does the same job, yet its use is only at, I think, 23%. Why is it not being more widely used?
So just what protected urea is, first, like the fertilisers lead to some emissions of nitrous oxide, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. protected urea and indeed ordinary urea have much lower emissions of nitrous oxide than the conventional fertilizer, we'll call it, or the traditional calcium ammonium nitrate. So that's why we're anxious for farmers to switch to protected urea, which also has lower ammonia emissions. That's where the protection comes in. So why, and it is a cheaper source of nitrogen than calcium ammonium nitrate. So why aren't we further advanced, is your question. Well, look, we have made good progress. If you went back to 2018, protected urea was 1 to 2% of our total straight chemical nitrogen. It's now at 23%. And we need to get that much higher. But I think we're very much on that journey.
Is that because it's less profitable for the merchants who are selling it, for the people who are manufacturing it?
I wouldn't say that, really. I don't think that's the barrier to uptake, really.
I hear farmers saying that they just can't get it. They'd use it if they could get it, but they can't.
Yes, look, sometimes you hear those stories, but by and large, protected urea is widely available now. I think it's a change. Any change takes time, you know. So we're on that journey of change. I think the cooperatives all have incentives of some shape or form to their customers, to their milk suppliers, to use protected urea. So it is widely available. But look, it does require you to change the way you plan your fertilizer. It's a different product than the one you have been using. So there are elements of change that farmers have to adapt to.
Now, our Brenda was in Laois for the Irish Grasslands Association summer walk on the farm of an old countrywide friend, Bruce Thompson. By coincidence, she was there on the morning that these emissions figures, as 4.6% good news, was released by the EPA. So she asked some of the farmers who were present what they were doing to reduce emissions.
I'm Evan Hunt, a fairman in Tubbercurry in Sligo.
Can I ask, how old are you?
I'm 27. So it's myself and my father in farm partnership, milking 120 cows. So we've grown from 50 cows in the last 4 or 5 years. The system of farming in Ireland has changed drastically in the last 3-4 years, especially. So especially since I started farming, the changes has been huge.
And with that in mind, Evan, the EPA announced that agricultural emissions are down 4.6% in agriculture. Did you do anything in terms of reducing fertiliser use yourself?
So I suppose we took clover on board. We're now running at 50% of the milking platform with clover, so that has helped reduce air nitrogen usage.
How much would you say by?
We're probably down around 40% on our overall nitrogen usage. Now it's still early days. We probably have limited grass growth a certain amount by going head first into clover. But I suppose it's a learning curve too, and you get used to these things as you learn from your mistakes. You know, we needed storage, so we've built more storage to store our slurry. I suppose it gives us the capabilities of being able to put the slurry when and where it's needed, more than having to put it out because of no storage issues.
Hello, what's your name?
Jennifer Bracken.
Are you with child?
Yeah, I'm expecting. Yeah.
When is baby due?
September.
And are you a farmer?
Yeah, so we're farming at home. We have dairy farm and dairy beef farm at home, and then I'm working in the agricultural sector as well. But it definitely will be a real challenge going forward for farmers to try and get the most out of their land and try and get the grass tonnage up with a reduced fertiliser allowance.
So my name's Ed Payne, farming in County Roscommon in County Galway. So we're milking 2 units, a total of about 550 cows.
Wow.
Yeah. It's the right thing to do to try and use less nitrogen. There's other things now, lots of use more clover and other ways of getting around it. So implementing clover on the farm, being a little bit more maybe wise or scrutinising when I was spreading fertiliser, just making sure to spread at the right time and the right levels. So yeah.
So, Ed, was the cost of fertiliser with the Ukraine war a factor?
So, fertiliser has gone up in cost, but it's always in the back of your head. You try to keep your costs down.
I have a rare thing here. I have a Cork man who has secured 2 tickets for the All-Ireland.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, but yes.
You're not
saying. Well done to Cork and getting through.
What's your name?
Jerome O'Mahony. I'm farming down in a place called Drumleek. I'm a dairy farmer. And our milk goes to Carberry Milk Products, and they make Dublin nut cheese. We're seeding a new grass, it's called red clover silage for silage, and that needs very, very little nitrogen. It actually is a legume which absorbs nitrogen from the air, and that will save a lot of nitrogen going out on the farm.
Was cost a factor with the Ukraine war and the price of fertiliser going up?
Absolutely. The fertiliser went up about three times.
My name's Liam Barton, so I'm part-time farming there outside Rathdowney in County Laois.
Yeah.
My plan is to go milking cows there next year. Look, at the end of the day, I'm trying to grow enough feed for my animals. I don't want them starving. It's very important. But at the same time, we are having a very efficient approach on how we use our fertiliser on farm.
There has been a reduction in methane, but it's only small. Did you yourself do anything to reduce methane gas in your herd?
Methane is very hard to reduce, being a cow, not alone pups, but comes out the other end.
No, I know there's a lot of research being done in it, and in Chagas and the likes, and in Moor Park, so I'm keeping a tight eye on that.
Sure, look, I suppose with the methane, there's studies ongoing on feed additives and that, and it's hard to see when it's not on the ground.
Do you think you're going to try different things?
Yeah, definitely. Sure, you always have to be willing to move at times and keep up with the thing, or you'll get left behind. So, yeah, we will. Those things are changing so quick. You just have to be on the ball and ready to go.
Frank, things are changing quite quickly, perhaps quickly than even some of the people that Brenda was talking to there are aware. When I bumped into you recently at the Open Day in Grange, I was really struck by the very large number of tools in the toolbox now for reducing methane that Chagas has developed and is trying to point out to farmers that are out there.
That's right, Philip. And, you know, as you say, we had a lot of those technologies on display at Grange, and we actually have another big open day next Tuesday in Johnstown Castle that will talk about all the technologies that are there for sustainable farming. So in terms of, it was great actually to hear those farmers, and just going back to their fertiliser nitrogen use, you know, it was a consequence maybe of the price, but they planned around things like clover and so on to be able to adapt in the longer term to lower nitrogen. And I would say...
So does that mean, are you hopeful that there won't be any diminishment or decrease on that 4.6% next year, or as prices become more favourable?
It certainly, look, we as I said, we were probably expecting some bit of a rebound in fertiliser use. I don't think we're going to see much of it this year. We may see a little bit next year, but not certainly back to the levels of nitrogen use that we had 3 years ago. Okay. When we were using 400,000 tonnes. So, but I think, you know, those farmers, was great to hear their level of knowledge around these things as well. In terms of reducing methane, there are a range of technologies, and those farmers, I would say, are already using some of them, maybe a little bit unknown to themselves. The big one being that farmers can do now to reduce methane is try to reduce the age at slaughter of our beef cattle. And dairy farmers have a huge role to play in that as well, because 60% of our beef cattle now come from the dairy herd. And what dairy farmers can do is breed better calves for the beef industry, I suppose using sex semen, so that we have less male dairy calves, but also for the dairy beef calves, that we're using the DBI to breed calves with better beef characteristics that will grow faster and finish earlier.
Away from that, on the feed additives, I think, again, one of the reasons that there might be confusion is that the research chops and changes backwards and forwards. At one moment, seaweed is promised as a silver bullet, and then a year or two down the line into the research, seaweed isn't that promising. Where are you now? What tools are available?
So in terms of, as I said, the most immediate tool is just that good husbandry, so we get earlier slaughter of our beef cattle. In terms of additives or things like that that you might actually, you know, incorporate into the diet, there's two strands of research. There's feed additives and there's slurry additives, because about 10 to 12% of our methane comes from slurry. So on the slurry side, just to deal with that first, you know, we have evaluated additives that will reduce the emissions of methane from slurry by about 78%, somewhere of that order. We'll say up between 75 and 80%. So, and the technology is there, I suppose, for that to be used on farms. On the feed additive side, we've tested and are testing a range of things, as you say seaweed, I suppose oils, essential oils. And probably the one that gets most of the attention are methane reducing and methane inhibiting
compounds.
How
many of those are farm ready?
There's just one, I suppose, that's licensed for use by the European Food Safety Authority in dairy cattle. There's some other very promising products coming through the system, but they will have to go through that licensing system before they can be used as feed additives for dairy cows.
Your job in Chagask is to do the research, to put the tools into the toolbox, to return to that metaphor. Your job is not to devise incentives or rewards for farmers to use them. That's down to the government and to industry. Without those incentives, Frank, do you think that there is a risk that some of these tools might sit unused in the toolbox?
Absolutely. So, you know, when we were advising farmers to use things like protected urea, we were able to say, look, there's a financial benefit to you as well. For feed additives or slurry additives, we can't say that. We can't point to any financial benefits. So, you know, for a farmer, it's just an additional cost. So there's going to have to be some incentive to farmers or some support to them to cover the cost of those technologies, or we won't see them being adopted on farms.
And here's a useful example of what can be achieved when industry does come up with incentives. The dairy industry realised that it was facing a public relations crisis in the treatment of unwanted bull calves. So strong market signals were sent to farmers about what they wanted to see happen. We saw that the use of sexed semen increased by 50% year on year in the course of the last 2 years. Rapid, effective, concerted action taken and results seen in a pretty short period of time. By analogy, the same thing can be done around breeding, can't it?
It can. And look, I would say in the whole sex semen story, which is a good success story, you know, back 6, 7, 8 years ago, we were doing the research that would allow us to give farmers confidence that this would be a technology that would work. And the advice plays an important role. And the stimulus from the industry, you know, the pressure, I suppose, that the industry was under, as you say, from the calf issue. All that coalesced to make sex semen now a widely used technology. And certainly animal breeding is another one of the big technologies we see to reduce methane in the longer term. And we will need the same sort of, you know, coalition of people working with farmers to see that widely used across the industry.
So the research in isolation isn't much use. Industry has to be there, and government and the department have to be there and say, now here, lads, this is what we want you to do, and here's going to be the rewards for doing it.
Exactly. It's a coalition of supporters we need working with farmers.
Listener question, is there a risk to human health associated with the use of protected urea? Are there compounds in it that are harmful?
No, that's been well tested, the whole efficacy and safety of products like that. And they've been used for many, many years, not just in Ireland, but in you know, for decades in different parts of the world.
Take me back to the other tools that we haven't discussed for methane reduction, those that were on display at Grange.
Well, I suppose, you know, we talked a little bit about the additives. There's different types of additives, you know, oxidizing agents, methane inhibitors. There's the seaweeds. Seaweeds are something that certainly have promise. But there are many, many different types of seaweed. You know, seaweed is not a single product, and the ones that grow in Irish waters don't appear to be very effective at reducing methane. There are red seaweeds that do appear to be very effective. The challenge with something like seaweed is, how are we going to get enough of it to feed to a lot of cows so that we can make a difference to our emissions? And obviously it has to go through a lot of safety testing as well, because there's some fairly strong compounds in red seaweeds that bring about this reduction in methane. And we have to make sure there's no human health implications, no animal health implications, or no impact on the processability of milk that might come from cows.
And given that seaweed does such a good job of storing carbon as it is, it might actually end up being a zero-sum game harvesting this stuff to only put it into cattle.
Well, look, you'd have to look into all that, but I think we'd be probably looking to grow extra seaweed more than what's been currently in the seaweed cycle if we went down that route. But look, I think we're probably a long way from being able to say that seaweed is something that we're going to see widely used on Irish farms.
Low emissions slurry spreading is something that we have seen wide uptake on now, partly because there's just so many contractors who are in a position to offer it. What contribution do you think, or do you know, has it made to the 4.6%?
So low emission slurry spreading, the direct benefit from that is that it reduces ammonia emissions, and that's why the big push was there to use that. It has an indirect effect on
methane. That's ammonia emissions directly to the atmosphere, which is not a greenhouse gas.
Which is not a greenhouse gas.
But exactly. Ammonia does turn into nitrous oxide on the soil, doesn't it?
A little bit of it does, but the big impact or the big indirect effect that low emission slurry spreading has on greenhouse gas emissions is that you can use less nitrogen fertilizer because you're using more of the nitrogen in your slurry. You're getting better value from your slurry. Also, you have much more flexibility in when you can apply and where you can apply slurry with that technology. So you can put it into a swar that you're going to graze 3 weeks later. So that means farmers can reduce their chemical fertilizer if they're using low emission slurry technology. That's the indirect benefit to greenhouse gases from it. And, you know, we heard those farmers earlier reducing their fertilizer by 40, 50%. It's through using technologies like low emission slurry spreading, clover, and better timing of when they use their slurry that's allowing them to do that and continue to grow enough grass for their cattle or their cows.
Joe in Carlo has texted 51551. It's my belief that Chagas made an error in promoting low emissions slurry with a single focus on emissions but no regard for soil health, water quality and microtoxins associated with the use of low emission slurry spreading. Does he have a point?
We've been promoting low emission slurry spreading for years. Primarily the advantage we were telling farmers about this was that this will allow you to get better value from your slurry. It'll allow you to reduce the smells, it'll allow you to graze the grass more quickly than if you applied with a splash plate. And there should be no difference to its the benefits of slurry on soil health if it's applied by a low emissions technology or a splash plate technology.
Okay, while Brenda was asked that Irish Grassland Association walk in Laois earlier in the week, she also asked farmers how things were going generally, you know, as you do, and she was taken aback by how downbeat the response was.
David Kerr from Ballyfin, just down the road here. I'm farming. Maybe longer than I should think about, to be honest, but it's definitely been the most challenging year in my farming lifetime, mentally, physically. The spring was just relentless. You just couldn't step away from it. It was one challenge after another between the weather and everything else that goes with it, because if the weather's not with us, it's a very hard ship to sail.
Yeah.
I'm really concerned, you know, there's a little bit of a drop-off in attendance today. You know, there's a lot of negative talk. You know, fellas are a little bit broken. Like, you know, we can't take any more of this punishment from the weather and whatever everything else. And we're looking for a break. And I'm just concerned, especially with younger guys. You know, there's going to be issues, I think, with cash flow on farms now because of what's happening. And I would be concerned about mental health issues now on farms really going forward, because we're into the month of July now and things need to turn very, very quickly.
And Henry Welsh from the outskirts of Galway City in Ordinmore. We're making around 300 cows.
Okay.
My son is farming full-time with me and one of our neighbours.
And a tough year.
Very challenging year, Brenda. Economically, it was very challenging to start with. Then the weather proved really challenging. The summer has been non-existent so far. So at the moment, we're looking for a kind of a silver lining. We're just hoping that kind of best practice will get us through, best use of our resources will get us through. Very, very, very important, as we said, that we attend events like today and speak to our fellow farmers and kind of be reassured that we're not alone in all of this, that a lot of us are facing the similar challenge.
Mm. And David, can I ask you, mentioned the tough year that you've had, that so many farmers have had, and how hard it's been on people's mental health. What have you felt? What have you seen?
I've seen there last April when we were in the peak of it, just guys had nearly lost their will to talk, slumped against a wall, you know, at meetings, and things that maybe a spring that I hadn't experienced before, my generation, you know, and I hope the younger generation don't experience too many more of them. But it just shows us really nature has such an effect on us. You know, the climate, the weather, you know, it has an effect, and we can do nothing about it if it works against us. You know, and we just have to work our way through. But we are all here now, but it's still a difficult year, whatever way you look at it. And as Henry mentioned there, we're facing into the challenges as regards fodder for next winter. The farm here mentioned the issues of possible cash flow implications, maybe reducing stock numbers. We have to look at things that maybe we haven't done in the past. You know, reducing stock numbers may be an anathema to a lot of us through our farming career. And now maybe it's an essential just to balance the fodder budget.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at, really. Something I wouldn't have thought about before, but I'm doing it. Mm. Yeah, because you have to make the balance the budget anyway.
Well, gentlemen, I've held you up enough in the rain.
You're fine. Nice
no, I really
you,
appreciate
yeah.
it. And thank you so, so much. Thank you.
Yeah. Be kind to us now.
Be kind to us now. David Kerr, Henry Welch, not newcomers. They'd be fellows who'd be well used to the ups and downs that farming provides people. So you can imagine how others not as hardened would be faring. What do you have to say to them?
So, look, that was a dairy farm walk that that Brenda was at. And I think, you know, dairy farmers obviously been very challenged. But if you were at a tillage farm walk, you know, tillage farmers have had a very tough year as well. And so have dry stock farms. So it has been a tough, tough 12 months. It started raining around the middle of last summer. And really, it's, you know, you could say it's been relentless poor weather since then. But farmers are very resilient. And I think the key thing, and look, we heard it there, is about planning, you know, and plan early. Put a plan in place. We know that we're back from fodder, from our fodder reserves for next winter than where we would like to be. We're about 10% lower than in terms of fodder made to date.
Don't plan on last year being the outlier or the unusual year. Should we be thinking about this as the kind of the new baseline?
Absolutely. Look, I think since the big drought of 2018 and when, you know, we had to import fodder into the country, if you remember, during the summer of 2018, the advice to farmers has been to carry at least a 20% reserve of fodder over and above what you would normally use.
And increase your slurry storage?
Obviously as well. But I think that stood us in good stead for the winter just gone by. You know, we had a very long winter, a late spring. And while some individual farms ran short of fodder, it was available in the country. We need to build back up those reserves now. And there's a job of work to be done because in the first half of the year, it wasn't great for fodder production. So farmers need to plan and talk to their advisor about how they can build back up those reserves in the remainder of the year.
Good advice there. But certainly my main takeaway from this is that while you have provided all of the research in the world for farmers to build on and improve on those methane reduction figures without industry and without government also saying, here's how we're going to help you, here's how we're going to incentivize you, we're not going to get anywhere.
Absolutely. Look, we are one cog in the wheel, but there are other important cogs in the wheel as well.
All right. Professor Frank O'Mara, thank you very much for joining us in studio this morning. More after this.
Email countrywide at rte.ie.
This weekend in the Irish Times, as Simon Harris approaches the end of his first 100 days in office, Pat Leahy assesses the performance of the TikTok Taoiseach. Marriage to Cillian Murphy means Yvonne McGuinness lives on the fringes of a starry world. But the Dublin artist explains why a mucky field is more alluring than a red carpet. In sport, Kevin Kilbane offers his take on New Ireland manager Hamir Halicomson, and John O'Sullivan interviews Jack Crowley before Ireland's second test against South Africa. Buy in store or get it delivered to your door. The Irish Times. Because you get it.
Tesco Mobile would like to confirm that the following offer is correct. You can get the Samsung Galaxy S24 for only €49.99 on our €45 plan. The €300 saving is not a mistake. Sorry about the confusion. It really is that good a deal. This is Supermarket Mobile. Tesco Mobile. Every little helps. While stocks last, applies to bill pay customers on our €45 per month plan. 24-month contract. Offer ends 6th of August 2024. T's and C's apply. See tescomobile.ie.
There's 25% off all school uniforms at F&F until Sunday, 14th of July with your Tesco Club card or app. The smart kids know now is the best time to get great value on uniforms. F&F makes fashion sense. Offer only valid on kids' school uniforms, school footwear, socks, tights and underwear. Selected F&F kids' bags included. Accessories excluded. To qualify, present your club card or app at the time of purchase, subject to availability. Offer valid until 14th of the 7th, 2024.
The body is that of a 35-year-old. Significant lesions to the face, particularly the right temple, correlating to the intracranial hemorrhaging observed. Seatbelt abrasions clear across chest and abdomen. Broken femur and tibia, right leg. Cause of death, drink driving. Drink and drive, and you could put someone on a mortuary slab. A message from the Road Safety Authority. Visit rsa.ie.
RTE Radio 1.
Madness!
In the middle of our street.
C'est la vie Summer Tour 2024. Live at Galway Summer Sessions. Saturday, August 10th, Galway Airport. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie. Madness! Live at Galway Airport.
Shuttle services running to and from Air Square. See expressway.ie.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
So you may have heard that there's a big match on Sunday. England will, of course, be playing Spain in Berlin, 8 p.m. kickoff, which once again raises for us the perennially thorny issue of who do we support. Is there any chance that any of us are going to be chanting this?
It's coming.
Or will we be busting a move and popping hips to this? Of course, I'm only trolling you. There isn't actually really a choice, is there? We all know what most of us are going to be doing. And in one house in Kerry in particular, there is absolutely no choice whatsoever. And wait till you find out why that is. Derek Twiss from Milltown Castlemaine GAA Club is on the line. Good morning, Derek. How are you?
I'm good, Philip. How are you? Good morning.
So take us through this step by step. A number of years ago, you got yourselves an au pair and you were all sitting down watching television.
That's right, yeah. Back in 2016, Adriana came over to us. She was with us for about 6 or 7 months. So, yeah, and the first week or two, she was sitting watching a Real Madrid game with myself and my wife. And just in passing, she said she was a season ticket holder. And then about 5 minutes later, she said she was going out with one of the players, which turned out to be Danny Carvajal. So it
hang
came
on,
a surprise to us.
Literally, you see him at right back there. I'm going out with
That's
him.
Right. So, yeah, yeah. And she said, she never made a deal of it. To be honest with you, she's from Madrid herself, and her family would be. I think there were generations. They're kind of going back as season ticket holders.
Was it introduced into the conversation so casually in a way that you might not have believed her, or that it was absolutely credible?
We didn't believe it at the start, to be honest. It was just kind of said so casually, and then she started to show us a few pictures, and when she was at matches and they'd be hanging around with Ramos and Pepe and all these other guys. So to be well known, but yeah, it was a shock in a way, but she was very down to earth all the time, so you wouldn't take much notice
of
it.
It's just as well you did believe her then, because Danny turns up with a boot full of footballs and jerseys in Castlemaine.
That's right. About a week before, he played the Champions League final. I think he flew into Dublin. A week before, and he drove from Dublin down to Kerry. He was on the phone to me just looking for the address of the house, so he wanted to surprise Adriana. Came down, spent about 2 or 3 days, I think, here, and did all the usual sightseeing in Kerry, and then headed back to Dublin to fly back for the Champions League final. It turned out he actually got injured in the final. He pulled a quad muscle, so I hope all the driving and flying had no part to play with that.
Well, that's some drive from Dublin to Castlemaine. It must have been love at the time. And you brought him to, a slightly different code.
Sightseeing. Yeah, and then I just brought him to my own local club, is Milltown Castlemaine, so they were playing one of the evenings, I think it was Saturday or Sunday evening, so I brought him back to Clarendon to watch a match. But yeah, we went, I suppose we were there for the start of the game, and I could notice a few younger guys kind of all elbowing each other and nodding to each other, and they actually started to recognise Danny. So they came back and asked for a few pictures. A lot of people, I'd say about 20 or 30 young guys, got photos taken with him at the time, but he genuinely was a very, very down-to-earth guy. You know, if you met him, you wouldn't think for a second that he'd have the profile that he has, and the club and the country he plays with. But
what did he make of GAA?
A bit confused, I'd say, at the start, to be honest, taken back with some of the physicality in it. But even that night, he was looking to kind of find out more about it. So I showed him a few clips from Croke Park when Kerry were playing in a few All-Irelands and stuff. And he just couldn't get over that it was an amateur status, you know, with 80,000 plus people watching it. That was more capacity than the Bernabeu had at the time. So yeah, he couldn't get over it, to be honest. But
I'd say he couldn't, because I have to confess, I went and I looked up his salary. This is a man who's on €1 million a month. So it must have absolutely blown his mind that there's people not only not making money, but probably losing money on the pitch.
Probably losing money on it, yeah. But that was kind of details behind the GA, I suppose, and I was trying to explain that as best I could. Now, his English wouldn't have been perfect at the time, but Adriana was translating. So, yeah, it was an experience. It's something at times you look back and actually think, did it happen at all? But like he returned the favour then by bringing us over to Madrid.
Okay,
and
now
I think it was January in 17. I think he brought us back over to the game then as well. So yeah.
Spoiler alert here. I also googled Danny Wife, and her name is not Adriana. It didn't last.
No, that's right. No, it didn't last. No, he's actually happily married now, and he's one or two kids. But he still stays in contact the odd time through my wife with Instagram and stuff. If we put up any posts in relation to our kids, he'd always like them and kind of give a reaction to it. So it's nice. And I think himself and Adriana still, they parted in good ways.
Good.
It was just a thing that Adriana continued to travel, and she's over in South America at the moment. But there's never a time goes past that she wouldn't send a voicemail for the kids' birthdays and stuff. So
sounds like an absolute gent, and somebody who leaves you with absolutely no confused loyalties whatsoever. You're obviously going to be sporting Spain.
Yeah, we'd have been soccer fans before, and you'd always kind of support Real Madrid with the players they had. But to bring us over to Madrid, he brought my son down into the dressing room after the game, and he actually got a picture with every player inside in the dressing room. And like, he met Sergio Ramos, Pepe, Ronaldo, Marcelo. Morato is actually Adriana's father, is Morato. He's the current captain of Spain. He's actually Morato's godfather as well. So there's a very close connection to the club through their family and that. And yeah, for us to be part of it was something special. He gave us signed jerseys, signed football, and one of the names on it would be Ronaldo's, but like they were called the Galacticos at the time because they had such an array of top quality players. But it was class, and it's nice to look back at
that. You do the name dropping so fluently and so well that I'm sure there'll be some who'll be listening to this and doubting it all. So we have put pictures up on Twitter on the Countrywide account that establish and support all of the things that you're saying here. Derek, hope you enjoy the match on Sunday. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning.
No problem.
Take care.
Okay, thanks very much.
Good luck.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Now, there's a few weeks back, you might remember that we devoted a whole programme to Park na Siúntaí na Mara Cíorcaigh, our newest national park. And during the course of that programme, in conversation with an expert, a baby puffin was referred to as what I always thought that they were called, a puffling. And then all hell broke loose. Of the 250,000 people listening to the programme that morning, it seems that one half of you instantly went, "Oh, puffling, that's adorable, absolutely perfect fit." And the other half of you let out a hue and a cry. "What nonsense are you on about, Philip? What a made-up word that is. Sentimental, soppy silliness. There is no such thing as a puffling. You meant to say puffin chick." Anyway, the powers that be in here said, "Philip, you better go and sort this out before it becomes yet another thing that divides the nation." So last week I returned to Kerry and boarded a boat to Puffin headquarters in Ireland, Skellig Mhíle. Straight off the boat and into a cathedral of crying kittiwakes and crashing waves. The plan was for a bit of gentle puffling spotting on a sunny morning.
I'm not a professional in the birds at all. I am.
But plans change as myself and OPW foreman Pat O'Shea were thrust immediately into a fully fledged puffling rescue operation.
What have we here?
We got a baby puffin.
This is actually a puffling, is it?
It's a puffin chick.
Yeah.
What happened to him?
He's come down from he's flown the nest, and he didn't make it to the water. So he actually, they come onto the road here, a percentage of them, because mm-hmm. They just misjudge them. They fly over to the water. And if they don't make it to the water, there's a good chance that the black-backed gulls will pick them up and have them for breakfast.
Okay.
And
Human intervention is required here.
It is, yeah.
Fully-fledged rescue operation is a poor choice of words. Once a puffling is fully grown, its parents leave it to fledge by itself, throwing itself off the top of Skellig Michael and into the sea. But each day, there's a handful that don't make it all the way to the water.
Plan now is to put that chick in a box and let them until nightfall, before dark. And we release them then.
Because of the risk of spreading avian flu either to the chick or from it to other birds, Pat takes me to find the island's resident ornithologist, Brian Power, who always has a supply of latex gloves for these situations.
So does this happen often?
With the pufflings, yes, it does. We have get a chick or two most nights that might not necessarily make its whole way down. Because usually they come down, they bounce their way down, but you have a gap covering a large chunk of the island from the landing up to the old lighthouse.
You mean this man-made path and wall
yeah.
are preventing their natural bump and fall passage down to the sea?
Yeah, it can do. It just depends on the line and the angle they come down or which section they come down.
How many have you picked up today?
None so far today. I covered a good chunk of the top part of the island and there was no activity down.
Here he is now. Look at him.
Yeah.
Quite dirty.
Okay, but it is a better size than some of the ones that have been coming down. So what we'll do is we'll keep this and we'll release it this evening at dark.
Explain to me why at dark.
So usually they come down at dark to avoid predation. So basically if a chick was to move from its nest during the daytime and make its way down, it would most likely get picked off by a predator, which out here would be usually...
herring gulls?
Various gulls, great blackbacks, herring gulls, lesser blackbacks, and also there are ravens out here as well.
So how are you going to handle this little fellow now?
Very gently. Keep the wings from flapping mad and keep the head in a position where it can't peck.
Now, how does he look to you?
Feather-wise, it's quite good. It's quite advanced. The eyes aren't fully open at the moment, so we'll have a look at that later on. This evening, then, prior to release, we'll take a weight and a wing length just to have data to compare.
On our way back, with rescued puffling in latex-covered hand, we bumped into Catherine Merrigan, one of the OPW tour guides, who also moonlights as a puffling foster parent and has a zip-up pet carrier for the rescued chick.
So you've met Catherine. Catherine does has done a lot of puff and rescue over the years.
Have you?
Hundreds. I'm here 24 years, yeah.
Really?
Looking after these little fellas.
Yeah?
If they weren't here, I probably wouldn't be here. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
They're quite special, aren't they?
They're amazing. They're the entertainment of being living on Skellig's big time, yeah. Absolutely.
That's fascinating. So am I alone in finding the puffins incredibly entertaining to look at and just to watch?
Absolutely not. Are you alone? I'd say most people think the same because they are so incredibly hilarious. I spent hours, like I've been working here for 24 years, and there's not a day goes by that I spend hours here. I finish work, I go back up and sit with the puffins. I sit and knit and take photographs. That's what I do, looking at the puffins and just watching them as they move around, their interactions. I just think they're hilarious. But you know, they're not only cute, they are feisty out.
Well, this is what I was going to say. I think that they are comic to look at, but my God, they take themselves very seriously.
Oh my goodness, they have really attitude, big attitude, and you should see them fighting. Oh my God, they're like I always say, one of my jobs is breaking up puffin brawls because they literally kill each other. Beak to beak, rolling down the cliffs. And then if they hit the cliffs, they will actually die. So I try and intervene, and maybe I shouldn't. But this road, you see, was built by humans, and it actually does kill a lot of birds, you know, because there's nowhere for them to actually get away over the wall.
Okay.
What are they fighting over? Burrows?
Oh, they're fighting over burrows. They're fighting because they just want to fight just for a bit of fun, I think, really. And also the women. Mm. Yeah, if they're, you know, come near my woman and, you know, absolutely no way, not near my burrow, not near my woman. And especially this time of year, they're becoming really frisky because their work is mostly done. You know, they've been here since April. Their chicks, a lot of them have fledged. And now this is the most hilarious time. Like yesterday, I mean, I have 100 videos, even from last night, like of them coming into my cabin. You know, they come they come into my cabin. They come in under my bed. Sometimes it's hard to get them out. One of them went into my cupboard.
Are they looking for warmth or are they looking for food?
They are looking for anything new to watch. Oh, they're just, this time of year, it's just hilarious. You could find them everywhere.
The puffins that burrow along the path to the beehive huts are neither wary of nor interested in the human beings passing by. They just come and go on their comically short wings as if you weren't there. Reinforcing that sense that despite this being one of the most famous places that humans have made their home in Ireland, the island really belongs to the puffins. Puffins are endangered. The European population has dropped by nearly 70% in the last 50 years. So when Brian spots another puffling in distress, the second rescue operation of the morning is launched.
She's got its head stuck.
In the rock? Yeah. How did it manage to do that?
She was just trying to find a safe space. I'll let you in there.
They're not very good at this whole leaving the nest business, are they?
This year has been completely out of whack. Last year we had a marine heat wave, and we don't know if that was the cause of it or not, but the puffins left. All the nests I was monitoring had finished by about the 24th of July. It's usually I'd be monitoring a few nests still around the 7th of August, so...
Is there enough food for this population of puffins and all the other birds of these islands in these waters?
It's an interesting question. So last year, again, the marine heat wave I mentioned earlier, we were kind of hypothesising last year that the puffins might have been able to provision their chicks at a faster rate. And if we're going to get more events like that, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen with food source.
10% of the global population of puffins live between Ireland and Scotland. Preventing their habitats being overfished will be critical to giving them a fighting chance into the future. The government here has come under fire for not giving greater priority to getting the Marine Protected Areas legislation passed before a general election.
This is really their island, you know. I mean, there's 8,000 puffins. They come back to the same burrow every single year to the same partner. Some have been tagged and some of them are reached the age of 30, 40. So this is their home.
Now, you just said puffin chicks.
Pufflings.
Which is it?
Pufflings.
But you did say puffin chicks.
Yeah,
I did hear you say puffin.
I did, but I do. I say pufflings or I say puffin chicks.
So are there two kinds of people in the world? Those who say puffin chicks and those who say pufflings?
Yeah. It depends on the day. Yeah.
Catherine Merrigan there. The rescue puffling / puffin chick Derry Londonderry was returned safely to the high seas that night. On the remote island of Countrywide, Brenda Donoghue is in the puffin chicks camp. Amandine Passo-Devine is in the puffling camp. James Feeney is too smart to get involved in all of this. Ella McSween is with you next week, and for a couple of weeks she will sort this mess out. Until a few weeks from now, have a good weekend.